This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Hi, this is Per Fogring, host of Fight the Empire. 40 years ago, a groundbreaking book was published called The Limits to Growth. MIT researchers used computer models to project the future world economy, and many of the results pointed to collapse. Thursday's guests will be author Christian Parenti. We will discuss the limits to growth and where it all leads. That's Thursday, January 3rd at 9:30 a.m. on KBOO, your radio station.
Don't let Rupert Murdoch control your newscasts. The KBOO Evening News provides breaking news about local issues, from water fluoridation to immigration raids. We bring you daily coverage of what's going on in Portland, Cascadia, and around the world. Tune in every weekday at 5 for the KBOO Evening News on KBOO, your community radio station.
And good morning. Welcome to Political Perspectives. My name is Paul Rowland, and we were just listening to Dancer's Groove, Northern Cree drum group, Cree Round Dance songs. And my guest in the studio is Myron Lehman, who himself is Cree from Alberta. And we're going to be talking about Idle No More, a very, to me, amazing, it sort of took me by surprise and probably took a lot of people by surprise, Indigenous uprising that's only about a month and a half old at this point, obviously has deep roots, which we're going to talk about on this program. And I have on the phone Sylvia McAdam, also Cree from Canada, and Georgina Lightning. And we're going to be talking in depth about this Idle No More movement, its roots, where it's been going, and where it's headed. And I'd just like to say hi to Myron this morning.
Oh, good morning.
And so Myron is in Portland, and I met him actually at the New Year's Eve sobriety powwow at the convention center, and sort of by happenstance got hooked up. It's really nice to have you in the studio.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
And I'd just like to, before introducing our phone guests, talk a little bit with you. So you've been in Portland for a while?
Yeah, I've been in Portland for 2 years. I was born and raised in northern Alberta. I grew up on Beaver Lake Cree Nation. It's northeast of Edmonton, sort of halfway between Edmonton and Fort McMurray. Uh-huh. Moved here 2 years ago with my wife and two children, and was pretty politically active in Canada, and continued on to make a documentary regarding a court case that my tribe is involved in against the federal government and provincial government concerning oil sands extraction within our traditional territory.
Yeah, I was particularly interested to have you on because you're from the territory where the tar sands oil devastation is going on, and so we can talk about that as well, how that has sort of fueled the fire, so to speak, of this movement. Obviously, there's a lot of issues facing Canada's First Nations people. That's not the only one, but it's one of the most dramatic ones. If anybody's seen any of the film footage of what's going on up there, it's just mind-boggling. So your documentary film was called?
Extraction.
And that made the rounds, as we were talking earlier about it.
It made the rounds to numerous film festivals. I played it at Imaginative, the Margaret Mead Documentary Film Festival. National Geographic All Roads funded the project. They were probably the only people who would look at the project altogether. Like, I brought the project to several different funding sources, and it was just at the time, this was about 2 years ago, no one really wanted to touch the issue. And now I really want to do an addendum piece following up what's going on up there, because the court case is moving forward. And especially now that this movement's really picked up, you mentioned how you were surprised, how you were kind of with this movement, how it just sort of came out of nowhere. For me, it's I feel just the same.
So that's yeah. Well, that's something. If someone who's been really active, I guess, goes to show that. Not that people have been idle, but obviously there hasn't been this kind of swelling in, I don't know,
ebbs and flows, right? Yeah. You go into these periods of just activity, and then you sort of, you crash, because sometimes it felt like you were just hitting your head against the wall up there, where it's really hard. It was really hard to get people motivated about anything, because there were a lot of different things that were going on, and no one was speaking up about anything, and the people who did speak up were just ignored. And now I think just through social media, it's just really just spread so fast. And, you know, it's really, really, really surprising. And it's really exciting, I think.
So as we go along this hour, we're going to be talking about how it spread and, you know, the forms it's been taking. But right now I'd like to bring up Sylvia McAdam, who's a who's from the Whitefish Lake Reserve of the Cree Nation in Saskatchewan. The nearest city is Prince Albert. She's an instructor and a consultant, and she has a law degree. So she's, if anybody up there is equipped to deal with the complexity of the legislation that it sparked this whole movement initially, this complex set of legislation, which is going to dramatically change the treaty relationships, land relationships, a lot of things. It's Sylvia McAdam, who is one of the four women who started doing teach-ins on this legislation back in November. Sylvia, are you with us?
I am.
Good morning. How's the weather up there?
It's good. It's good.
Good. So yes, so I just gave a real thumbnail sketch of the beginnings of I Don't Know More back in November. I wonder if you could share with our listeners how you got involved and why you got involved.
Well, most of us, I won't go into detail about the history of residential school and all those dynamics about the pass and permit system, all the historical injustices that are carried over into this legislation. And how I got involved, I am not an activist. I am not an activist in any stretch of the imagination. I'm content to stay at home and just raise my kids. But I went home back to my reserve after being away for a long period of time. But I was always raised off of the land with my parents. My parents are very traditional Cree people, Nihiyawak, and they my dad lived, we lived off of the trap lines, we lived off of the land. So when I went back to, when I went to get my law degree, and after I got it, I stayed in the city a little bit longer, then I went back. And when I went back to the land, I was shocked. I was just shocked and devastated at how much damage was being done to my father's lands, the treaty lands, like the hunting lands. And it was affected me so profoundly to have to go back to the lands and see where the waters were, where we had once gone to drink from. This was like spring water that was coming from the ground. And then to go back and not find those things that have always been there affected me. So Nina Wilson and I became good friends on Facebook. And then it was that one day, I think it was in beginning of October, that somebody posted about Bill C-45. And I went in there. I can't even recall who posted it. It was just on a news feed. So I went in there, and Nina and I started talking about it. And then Jess Gordon and I, all three of us, started having a conversation on Facebook with in the backroom chats. And then I had just come from a rally on a totally different thing the week before that. And when we started exploring Bill C-45, we were stunned. We were stunned at the far-reaching implications, and the far-sweeping powers that the Aboriginal Affairs Minister would be given under this omnibus bill. So we decided that we'd do something about it. And we pulled Sheila McLean in there because when I went to that rally, she was organizing it. And I loved the way she organized it. It was so well done. So I pulled her into the conversation. And then we all decided that in law, there's something called acquiescence. Acquiescence means that your silence is consent. And we decided we couldn't be silent. So we started posting a teach-in on Facebook and just contacting our friends and people we knew all over the place. And then we created a hashtag called, you know what, we didn't even think of I Don't Know More as a movement at that time. The reason why we named it I Don't Know More was because it was our chat. We named that chat room, I'll Know More. And it was Jess Gordon that said that we can't be idle anymore. So we said, hey, let's call it I Don't Know More. And it wasn't to infer that other activists or other people who have worked so hard on the issues prior, it was no dishonor towards them at all. It's no way to infer that they were idle. But when it first started, we were saying that we were idle about Bill C-45. The four of us, we were idle about it. And by the time that I Don't Know More became really popular, we tried to change the name. And then by that time, we just couldn't because people already identified with I Don't Know More as the teach-in, as the information where they could go. And when we first did our teach-in in Saskatoon on November 10th, there was a good number of people that came out. And out of those teach-ins, we were getting stories, and people were sharing how they hitched rides to come there and how people walked even in the blizzard to come to these teach-ins.
So it sounds like people were just waiting for something like this to happen almost.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's a combination of other Indigenous activists laying the foundation, like the seeds for this movement to come together. And we were so profoundly lucky that I had the law knowledge. And then Sheila was very good at organizing rallies. And Jessica, you know, she's so good at the administrative part that you witness on our blog there. She's so good at doing stuff like that. And Nina brings her Dakota knowledge about the land and the medicines into the whole thing and how important land is to Indigenous people. And that's what we talked about that day at the teach-in. And there was a mix of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people that came together. We had David Forbes from NDP that came and spoke there, and he had really good stuff to say. And to say that this movement is very Indigenous driven is not totally accurate, because Sheila is non-Indigenous, and she plays a very vital role in bringing our allies together to join us in this movement. And I think that's what you're witnessing now. Not that I'm saying that she's fully responsible for it. There were allies there, but we've created a forum where all of us can come together that day at the teach-in, and it's grown since. And I'm very fortunate to be a part of it. And the four of us are not saying that we're fully responsible for what is happening. There are people like other activists that have planted the seeds there. So I'm so grateful for that work that they've done, and I'm so sad that it's taken us this long to get mobilized, but also very grateful that it is happening now and that we have the means to find a way to protect the land and the water, because Bill C-45 is a horrible piece of legislation that will do exactly that.
On that note, I'd like to bring in Georgina as well, who's on the other line, and also invite Myron to add, so we could just sort of have a little round table discussion to get a little deeper into some of the different aspects of this bill. And there's a number of other pieces of legislation that are either pending or passed. I'm not even that sure. I've sort of been looking. It's very kind of confusing to me. But so, Georgina, are you with us also?
I'm with you.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a filmmaker, so I came to Canada because I'm working on a film trilogy, and one of them is called Path to Freedom, and it deals with some of the subjects that Sylvia is talking about, the past traumas, and where we're at today and where we're going. So this was just something that happened since I got here. I've been researching everything that's going on, and I've got footage of people talking, a lot of our chiefs and leaders talking at Mayfield Inn at a conference, talking about these bills that were proposed in February that Sylvia's talking about, the omnibus bill and everything. And so many people were talking about it, worried, stressed out, but like Marty says, it was like banging your head against the wall. There was frustration, but nobody knew how to deal with it. There was no collective energy. And then I went to the healing movement in Fort McMurray, the healing walk that happened there. And I saw firsthand what happens to land and environment when there's extraction with no safety, with third world country safety conditions and no concern whatsoever for land and environment. My voice right now, that's screwed up. It's been screwed up ever since then. We hiked 15 miles, and I had a camera. I was shooting everybody and talking like, why are you doing this? The air was like a thick, foggy day, and that was an everyday occurrence there. There was guns going off because of the duck ponds, because they can't touch the water. And there's an elder at where my tent was pitched saying, I was going towards the water. He goes, get out of there. He yelled, I'm like, what? And he goes, don't you understand that water is contaminated? This is traditional land where they used to fish. And he goes, people don't understand. Our traditional plants, our berries, our medicines, the animals that drink from that water, it's all contaminated. In Fort Chip, like some of the people that were marching, I'm like, why are you here? You're 76 years old. She goes, because we just buried my daughter and my nephew. And I mean, the reality kicked in. Over 50% of the people in Fort Chip are dying of cancer. Wherever there's extraction, there's death, and it goes hand in hand. From there, I was like inspired. I was blown away, and I was devastated, just like Sylvia, going home and seeing that the water was no longer there in her traditional lands. And I went to the Unstilltown in British Columbia, where they're going to lay this. And I was sitting down by the water, where they have salmon runs, and there's little bear cubs, and there's deer. But then you go to the street, the road there, and I had my camera pitched up there, and there's truckload after truckload after truckload. They are clear-cutting so fast to lay that, and that, all that land's going to be ruined. And I'm like, oh, my God, like, it's happening so fast. The pace and the safety standards are outrageous, and it's got to be stopped, and the only thing stopping them is the Native people. So we are the Indian problem once again. So by doing this, I really think that there's a backlog plan. This is a master plan. Get rid of the Indian problem, and we can extract as fast as we want, and we don't have to be concerned about anything. Well, as long as Indigenous people, or Native Americans, First Nations, whatever you call us today, as long as we're in place, what our treaties do is they protect the land. There's built-in, you know, it's built into there, the stewardship and protection of waterways and land.
Yeah, I just want to
remove the Indian problem. Then they can extract at the pace they want. They can export, and it's all about corporate greed. It's about money. They don't care about the lives. They don't care about the environment or the water. You know, and the one reason why everyone in the country or the world needs to be concerned about this. Because people turn off when it's like, oh, it's another Indian issue. Oh, it's a treaty thing. It's a bit. Mm-hmm. They turn off because this country is set up in Canada. They have a low rate of unemployment, but they're very high impoverished. Poverty is very high. The cost of living, people can't make it. They're stressed out. They're dealing with their own circumstance. They don't care if the Native American's struggling. It's like, I'm struggling myself as a nun. You know, they're sitting there going, I can barely make my payments. I can barely do this, and I can barely keep my kid in shoes. I can't worry about their problems. But when it comes to water, everyone needs to worry. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone needs to worry. We need water. The only way we cease to exist is if the sun stops shining and we run out of water. It's that crucial. It's life and death here, and I'm going to take it to that extreme. So, you know, to me, it's like we all, as a global community, Indigenous peoples all over, and every movement and every human being that cares about that. I mean, if you go to the store now, which I do, I go to the store and I pay more for a gallon of water than a gallon of gas. That's a crime already, and it's just going to get worse. Yeah. You know, in Fort McKay, you can't bath in your water more than 3 minutes. It's contaminated. And that's going to be everyone's reality.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So,
yeah, and that's it's going on with fracking. I was talking to a woman at a powwow on New Year's Eve who's Blackfoot from Montana, and she was talking about how fracking is now coming onto some of the reservations, and this thing is just spreading so fast as we're just...
Oh, it's been happening. 70% of the women have no breasts in that area. I mean, they can't feed their children. They can't breastfeed their own kids. I mean, that's the reality of the situation. But with blocked media, they don't allow that information to get out. I've been living in Los Angeles. I'm in the film industry. When I came here, I mean, yes, I've heard Tantu Cardo came and she showed a film. You know, she was staying at my house and we went and saw it. And I was like, really? Wow, that's really going on? I mean, how come I don't know about that and I'm in media? And so when I came here and actually went and I got invited to these places and I started shooting it, I was just dumbfounded. The world needs this. We need to get every filmmaker, everyone who's in the media to saturate the industry and the world with this reality, with the truth.
So I just want to invite
everyone. Is going to be true.
I want to invite Sylvia. I don't think Sylvia was able to be on for the full hour. I just want to invite you, Sylvia, to talk a little bit. Now it seems like there's the first phase, almost kind of like Occupy, which, you know, is sort of a interesting parallel. It sort of spread really fast, and then people were faced with the questions about, you know, where to go from here. It seems like there's obviously people are asking these questions. I've been following the I Don't Know More website, which they just changed to idlenomore.com. That's right, Myron, idlenomore.com.
Yes, I believe.
idlenomore.com. You can get all sorts of information. It's very interesting to follow the discussions on that website because people are really starting to take stock of, you know, that something really, some momentum has been created and where to go. So, Sylvia, I was just wondering, you know, now that, you know, you've seen this movement, you know, that you kind of helped get the ball rolling on, you know, just talk a little bit about, you know, how you feel about what you've been seeing about all these round dance flash mobs, which is a really interesting way of spreading the word, and where you see things going.
Well, you know what? There are approximately 13 other bills that we know of that are coming up. Bill C-45 has gone through. It's signed It's law now. That's done. But we focused on Bill C-45 because we knew it was going through. We were fighting that. And we're I don't like to use the word fight, but we're defending. We're defending our lands against that. There's also Bill C-27, the First Nations Financial Transparency Act, that's still coming. Bill S-2, the Family Homes on Reserve and Matrimonial Interests or Rights Act. And then there's Bill S-6, Bill S-8, Bill C-428, Bill S-207, Bill S-212. So some of these other bills that are coming up are worse than Bill C-45 in some respects, but they're all bad. They're all bad. They diminish the treaty understanding, the treaty relationship, and domesticates it. That's what it's going to do. It's also going to take away the jurisdiction and the power from the leadership and transfers that power over to the Canadian state. And I think people need to understand how terrible that really is. And in terms of Bill C-45, what we're going to see now is there's two elements there that we were defending ourselves against. And the first one is the removal of the Navigable Waters Protection Act. What Canada has done, what the Conservative government has done is they've removed that protection, and they are now only protecting less than 1% of the bodies of water and waterways in Canada now. And now what that's going to do is it's going to lower the threshold of the environmental assessments. And in some cases, no environmental assessments would be required of corporations. Hmm. And how that affects everyone is we all share the same water. And if the water is getting contaminated from Canada, it's going to flow into the U.S., guaranteed. We all share the same bodies of water. So if people value the clean drinking water that we enjoy in Canada and into the U.S., all of us have to mobilize on this. This is a global catastrophe at its worst, because the Harper government is saying to its Canadian citizens, and it's saying to the Indigenous people, that now you have to defend yourselves against the corporations that will have access to this water and to the land at will, with very minimum environmental assessment.
And I don't think people
are already having.
Oh no, there was no environmental assessment done before at all. When you look at even back at the oil sands project, it's been going on since the 1960s, and there's been no baseline study done to at all determine what kind of impact this project's been having. There's like no baseline study, and they're just now making their laziness like law. They're making it official. They're just allowing them. It's like we've been doing this before. But now they're calling us out, and let's just make what we're doing law. So now Harper, with a majority government, can pretty much sneak anything he wants right under everyone's noses, and no one's going to notice. No one's going to care. I'm frankly pretty sick of it. I'm also kind of frustrated with our own leadership, especially up north. I mean, growing up, all I've seen is a lot of leaders take kickbacks from oil companies. I've seen a lot of people I've seen a lot of corruption within our own systems of government. And, you know, that's all one good, because it's all based on, you know, the Canadian government anyway. It's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying. And especially down here in the States, it's like, there's already so much of a melting pot here that being a native person, you're already you kind of become invisible. But in Canada, native people are very visible, but we're very much ignored, nonetheless. And like, for me, I think this is stirring the pot. This is getting things going. There's a discussion going on that we're having discourse, and it's not, people are already comparing Idle No More to the Occupy movement. There's no leader. No one knows what they want. It's all, you know, how about you turn off your car? Idle No More. Ha ha ha. Let's just all make fun of it. Let's all laugh at it. And then what, you know, 20 years down the road, I mean, we've seen caribou, woodland caribou in northern Alberta deplete 90% in the past 10, 15 years, since this mega project really totally kicked in the mid-90s when they totally ramped up all their production, when it became profitable. And now Canada is the leading exporter of oil to the United States. Most of the petroleum, most of the gas, it's all coming from this project. And so it's not coming from Saudi Arabia. It's not coming from South America. It's coming from our backyard. And, you know, I think, isn't it time? Like, look at this project. If you're listening, just like Google oil sands or tar sands in Fort McMurray, and just look at some of the pictures. Go to Google Earth and have a look at this. This is ridiculous, and this is this whole process. It's like fracking, but with oil. And all that water, all that wastewater gets pumped out into these tailings ponds. It's earthen dams. The second largest dam in the world is an earthen dam holding back toxic sludge in Fort McMurray, Alberta. It's ridiculous. And if that dam breaks, it's going to pollute one of the largest freshwater sheds in the world. Not just Canada, not just northern Alberta, not just Northwest Territories, the world. I feel like I've been... shaken. Like, I've been shaken by this. Not by this project, but by this movement. And I feel like it's actually, it's woke me up. I feel like a lot more alert. I mean, I met you at that sobriety powwow. This past year, I've just been so frustrated with a lot of this stuff. And I've decided to make a lot of changes in my life in order to be doing the work that I totally gave up on, that I've been idle. Sylvia was speaking about, you know, you don't want to talk about activist being. I feel like I've been idle. I feel like I've just been, apathetic, like not wanting to do anything because, like, oh, no one's listening. Well, now I feel people are listening.
I just need to jump in, sorry to interrupt the momentum, but this is Political Perspectives on KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM here in Portland. My name's Paul Rowland. I'm hosting this show for my first time, and I'm speaking
You're
with...
You're doing a great job.
Thank you. Myron Lehman I'm with, who's from the Beaver Lake Cree up in Alberta, and I also have Sylvia McAdam from the Whitefish Lake Reserve and Georgina Lightning. And Georgina, where are you calling in from? Where am I talking to you from?
From Edmonton, Alberta.
You're in Edmonton. Okay, just want to get that set. Okay, well, I mean, I don't know if any of you need to leave, feel free to say your goodbyes at any time. I really think this is a great conversation, so I'd love to have you continue until you, as long as you can. So I think I wanted to, some of the things that Myron brought up, the issue of leadership. I mean, this is something in my, I used to be active in solidarity work with Native Americans here in the Northwest a number of years ago before I left for Italy, and I just recently came back, but that's a long story. At that time, I heard a lot of stories from people about, difficulties of the leadership on the reservations, but people didn't necessarily want to talk about it that much because it was kind of like non-Indians wouldn't understand, for one thing. It was kind of like that was like almost a secondary problem. They had worse problems. But I think, this, what the I Don't Know More movement from Canada is bringing up, and it might shake things up in the United States. It seems like a lot of people are getting on board with it here too, which we can talk about some in the time we have left. But it seems like this issue of the leadership, I've been noticing on the website, there's some really serious discussions of the need to keep this movement grassroots, that if some of the, the band chiefs, the First Nations leaders want to get on board, want to get involved with it, that's great, but they are not the leaders of the movement. I wonder if you all could speak to that.
I'll speak to it, and then I have to go. I'm sorry. We've stated time and time again, there have been individual chiefs that have supported I don't know more. And we're so grateful for that. They've even hosted us on their communities. But history has shown that when these movements occur, when leadership of any form, not just indigenous leadership, I'm not just referring to that kind of leadership, but we're talking about all kinds of leadership. Once they begin to take over these movements, they die. This movement is powerful because it is coming from the people themselves, the grassroots people. This is where the power is coming from. And we're trying to maintain that to the best of our ability. And we have to speak on behalf of the grassroots people when they tell us, you know, leadership can't take this over. We have to respect that because we know where it's coming from. However, in saying that, we're not excluding them. They are our people. They are grassroots. They're not going to be in positions of leadership forever. If they get into an election and they get booted out, it doesn't mean that they can't come here. It doesn't mean they can't come and support, I don't know more, as chiefs, as grassroots people. But we have to maintain the voice of the grassroots people. That's the whole purpose of I Don't Know More. And the other thing that I wanted to say is this is also elder-driven. We went to elders before we began I Don't Know More, and we asked for their direction, and we offered them tobacco and print and gifts. And this is their voice as well. This is how come we're maintaining that message of peace, unity, and solidarity. Because you look at other movements in the world, there's Gandhi, there's Martin Luther King, everything was maintained in a peaceful way. This movement has the potential to put in place the self-determination of indigenous people, and that's our focus, as well as bringing into focus that we need to stop these bills. These bills undermine our sovereignty, they undermine the treaty relationship, and it questions the compassion and the humanity of the conservative government, to allow Chief Spence to fast for that long. And my prayers are with her, but in saying that as well, I Don't Know More is the face of all Indigenous people. All Indigenous people, and that's what makes this movement have the power that it does. So I thank you for inviting me to come and speak in your radio station, radio speaking thing here. But I want to tell everyone this impacts all of us. I think that we're, not to sound gloom and doom, but I really believe that we are at a critical state. And whether we support I Don't Know More through prayers or coming out to the rallies, all of it is support. We're so grateful for that. Like Georgina has been a part of this movement since it almost first began in Edmonton, and I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful for all of that. It wouldn't be what it is today if we didn't have grassroots people be informed and realize that it impacts all of us, whether you're Indigenous or not.
Okay,
so
well,
I want to shake hands with all of the elders that are listening, all of your listeners. I'm grateful that they're tuning in and hearing this message.
And I thank you very much for, it's been very powerful. It's been very good to get your perspective, who've been involved in this from the beginning. I've been speaking with Sylvia McAdam. She's on the line from Saskatchewan. The nearest city is Prince Albert, from the Whitefish Lake Reserve of the Cree Nation. Thank you very much, Sylvia.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Bye.
And bye, Sylvia.
And we still have Myron Lehman in the studio, who's also Cree from Alberta, and Georgina Lightning on the phone from Edmonton. And I think one thing that's, you know, it brings up, I think it's really, I'm not sure how much people who are listening to this station, you know, it took me a long time to educate myself about the history and nature of Indian societies and how they've been changed by the whole colonization process and the nature of the government system that was imposed on them, all these very complex. But the whole issue of elders and the fact that, you know, indigenous people do still have more of an intact social structure than the rest of us. That's something that really struck me. And you really notice that with these round dance flash mobs. I want to talk about these round dance flash mobs because they're really amazing. I've been to two in Portland. I've seen a bunch of YouTube videos. I really recommend listeners to go to check these out. They're just so powerful. People just show up and there can be like five people with these hand drums, 10, hundreds. Theda Newbrest, who I spoke with, I did an interview that I am not able to interview this morning because there's so many live guests, but she talked about going up to one in Canada, and there's hundreds of people with these drums, and it's just such a different feeling from any other kind of demonstration I've been to. It just, there's a power to it that is really remarkable.
Well, there's a unity, there's a beat to it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's when you hear that much in unison, it's almost like I kind of compare something like that to a haka from the Maori in Aotearoa. It's almost like this. It has this this resonating power, and I felt it, you know, at the first flash mob here, because when I saw what happened in Edmonton, you know, that's where I was born, and I was like, wow, I wish I was there. I wish I was there to see that go down in West Edmonton Mall.
I wish I could
have seen the faces of just the passersby, because I feel, as an Indigenous person working in the media, I feel totally invisible. I feel like we have no representation whatsoever within the media. And for this to happen, to be happening through social media, through something that is user-driven, something that's, you know, that's being done by people who are just there with their phone, filming it, and then posted and then shared. The fact that we have more representation now online than we do through mainstream media outlets, it speaks a lot to just the where we are right now. You know, they just like sweep the Indians under the rug and they'll be okay. And they're like, well, everything will be fine. Everyone, this, I say this is about visibility. It's about being heard. It's about being seen. And I think it's getting its point across. And what a better way, you know, than to have a round dance. You know, traditionally we round danced, you know, to bring people together when it was cold, you know, and to hear, you know, Cree songs being sung, and you know, people speak a little bit about transculturation, but you know what, we've all borrowed stuff from each other's culture. We've all done that, and you know, and that's how you make a new tradition. And I think with this, it's about creating something new. I mean, to see the youth, the way the young people are getting behind this, it's amazing to see your nephews and nieces who normally are only posting stuff about Nicki Minaj or The Voice or like just, you know, ridiculous reality television stuff, to be understanding the issues or wanting to understand, to want to be engaged in that discourse. It's exciting. I almost feel like I've been waiting for this to start. I've been waiting for this for a while, and I don't think it's losing momentum. If anything, it's gaining momentum. I mean, you know, you think about Chief Spence and what, you know, what, 23 days now.
Yeah, that's something we haven't actually touched
23
on.
23 days she's been fasting.
And she's chief of the Attawapiskat from what region?
In Ontario. And it's, you know, the thing about this, you know, everyone thinks that this is about money. Everyone thinks that what we want is a big government payoff, a big check to have a shut up. This isn't about money. You know, and I think that's just something that a lot of non-Indigenous people don't understand. Even Indigenous people, I know there's some people who don't understand this movement, but it's not. It was never about the money. Even the lawsuit that my reserve's been involved in 2008, it's never about the money. All she wants is for Harper to sit down with Native leaders and talk about this. That's all she wants, and he won't even address it.
Okay, again, we're talking about Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister of Canada, just to make sure, because there are probably people who are listening who don't know that, who pushed through, his Conservative government pushed through this C-45 called the Jobs and Growth Bill. It's this huge 400-page document. I had on a woman, a Métis woman from Montreal, talked about on the news last Thursday and Friday, if you heard that, talking about this bill a little bit, which has a lot in it. As you heard Sylvie talk about, there's a whole bunch of other legislation. It seems to be a concerted attack on not just Indigenous people, but on environmental regulation. It's just like a general onslaught. It's basically like, it seems like the Jobs and Growth Bill is austerity plus deregulation.
Oh, that's what he named it?
Austerity plus...
Jobs and Growth
Bill.
Yeah,
Jobs and Growth Bill. Yeah.
Oh, it sounds so nice, doesn't
it? Yeah, it does. It's ominous. So I just want to go in a couple directions here. So we started to talk about Teresa Spence, the chief of the Attawapiskat, her hunger strike in the 23rd day now. And she says she's prepared to fast till the death. And her demand is to meet with Stephen Harper. I'm sure there's further demands. I mean, she's obviously involved in all this stuff. The demands are, you know, to stop this legislation, to, you know, respect treaty rights and all this, all the other things that the movement is demanding. But she specifically wants to meet with Stephen Harper, and he's refusing. And so, Georgina, if you want to talk a little about that, but also since Myron brought up these round dances, flash mob round dances in where that you participate in, maybe you could also talk some about that.
Well, it's the Chief Spence thing. I mean, that's just a complete, like, he's treating it like a joke. It's what he treats, you know, he's always treated Native people like. That apology in 2008 was a joke, and they've overthrown that as well.
Okay, I mean, say something about that apology.
New relationships and partnerships with, based out of respect. And the democratic process was completely avoided in this situation. So democracy is about listening to all the parties' voices and trying to find the best for all. It's not about shutting off debate or trying to rush things through the back door. And that's what he did, that 400-and-something page piece. You know, we've got letters from senators saying that, you know, to be honest with you, we really don't read those. The technical wording in the verbiage is so difficult. We need lawyers to dissect it. And it was 6-hour deliberation, and they passed through one of the largest legislations that ever passed in the history of Canada in 6 hours. I mean, there was just no stand for voice. There was no moment for voice or anything like that. And he continuously, like, snubs his nose down on Native Americans or First Nations, whatever we're called, you know, since the beginning of the formulation. So the 2008 apology only led us to this. I believe it was part and parcel of the whole solid plan. So the rest of the world looks at it after, you know, Kevin Rudd gave the apology in Australia. I mean, there was apologies all over. So it's like, I better jump on this bandwagon.
You have to explain what this apology was, though, because I don't think our listeners know.
Well, the apology in 2008 was from Harper giving First Nations people acknowledgement that repeated atrocities and violations and horrific crimes against Native Americans happened for years and years, and now we're going to stop and we're going to start and have this declaration of peace and try to talk to each other, like, you know, with respect, and we're going to consider you, and we're going to listen to your voice, and we're going to have a partnership here, because the treaties were based on sharing land, and, you know, it was all based on peace. It wasn't after war. It was based on peace. So we're going to go back to that. So the world gets to look at it and go, wow, Harper is really great to the Indigenous people. And now look what's happening. As everybody was going, oh, we don't have to worry about Canada. Canada's great. They treat their Indigenous people like gold. But they're apologizing. They're making amends. They're giving them seats at the table. And that didn't happen at all. And now he's looking at Chief Spence going, what a joke. I'm not going to do that. There was pictures of him on Christmas Day at a soup kitchen giving out food. Like, that, you know, in Calgary, that's what he was doing. Well, there was people over there, you know, with Chief Spence sitting outside freezing and fasting. And, you know, there's no acknowledgement of that whatsoever. He's not even acknowledging it.
I want to.
So what does that mean?
I want to also bring up something that Chelsea Vowell, the Métis woman from Montreal, brought up in the interview I did for the news last week, which was this Royal Commission on Aboriginal Affairs. That came to mind when you talk about the apology and this idea of sort of a concerted strategy to basically defuse any possible Native opposition to this taking of the minerals and whatever. And so she was talking about basically that Royal Commission being formed as a response to the two crises, the Meech Lake uprising and the Oka uprising around 1990. And those two, like especially the Oka situation, received massive international attention. At the time, it was akin to the Chiapas uprising. And there's an armed standoff for about 3 months. It's such a complicated story, can't go into. But out of those two incidents, those two situations, came this Royal Commission on Aboriginal Affairs to study the relationship, the issues, the problems, and come up with recommendations. And Chelsea Vowell said there's just like a whole series of pretty thorough recommendations to really address the situation, and basically none of them were really implemented. There is no implementation of that. And so on top of that, millions of dollars spent on that process, consultation with communities across Canada, 3 volumes, massive report, and then all these recommendations, nothing happened. And then on top of that, nothing happened. And then he issued this apology, which seemed to have been worth less than nothing. It's a little bit of historical context, but I'd like also to recommend to people, again, go to the idlenomore.com website. But there's also an interesting site called decolonize.wordpress.com. That's decolonize.wordpress.com. And I'm sure there's lots of other stuff out there. This is just what I've come across in my research. And there's an article in there called Idle No More in Historical Context, which really lays a lot of this stuff out. I think it's really worth reading. So I just like to say those things and leave it open for Myron and Georgina.
Yeah, it's, I really think that I just really hope that things that these channels of communication do stay open. I know Harper is not really, going to acknowledge Chief Spence at all. At least he's made no effort to. But when it comes to just on a person-to-person basis, I really think at that level, at this grassroots level, I think as long as that discussion, as long as we could just keep talking about these issues and get more awareness out there, then I think it's a win. It's a win, in my opinion. I really believe that both of our societies, Canada and even the United States, are not, in Canada, like we call it Métis. It's half French or Anglo and half Cree. And I believe that Canada is a Métis society. It's founded not only on European ideals, it's founded on indigenous beliefs as well. I think that we were just as much of a part of the forming of both of these nations. The Constitution of the United States was written by the Iroquois Confederacy. That's where they got that from. It wasn't a European ideal. And I think that we need to remind ourselves where both of these countries come from and the history. We are not a separate. I don't really believe that we are separate people. I think we are all part of this nation. And the reason why we're struggling so much to find an identity as Americans, as Canadians, is, because we're not acknowledging our own indigenous roots as nations. And I think this is starting that process. And I think it's waking people up to that. It's really important to me that this thing just keeps going on, like that we keep talking about this.
Georgina, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm further to what Myron's saying, like that whole I think that's a colonized attitude of saying Canada and America. So I 100% agree with you, Myron. This is our continent. It's an indigenous continent. We're all one. So by separating ourselves and saying Americans and Canadians, no. The strength comes in all of us being North American First Nations or Native Americans, whatever we call ourselves. And that whole division of the governing system of Canada or governing system of U.S., we have to take over our own governing system. We have to formulate the Native Party and insert ourselves. And with that apology in 2008 that Harper facaded, to the world, basically, ever since 2008, things have gotten worse. When I came back here, I was shocked just even going to the doctors or doing simple things or talking about my nieces and nephews about education. Since 2008, so I researched it, and Harper has cut Aboriginal health funding. He's gutted environmental reviews processes. He's ignored more than 750 missing and murdered Indigenous women across the country. He's withheld residential school documents from Truth and Reconciliation Commission. They abandoned land claim negotiations, and they defended its underfunding of First Nations school and child welfare agencies. I mean, we have more children in care today than we ever did in residential school. And people are just totally, they're not even aware of what's going on. And that is not a relationship based on respect, like he said in 2008. It's like, I don't know, he snowed everybody so that nobody was paying attention to the reality. But if you look at it, things have gotten so much worse. It's severely worse than it ever has been, and this is a state of emergency, and we need our brothers and sisters in the U.S. We need all Indigenous peoples collectifying their energies on this, and I really do believe that the only reason why this is as successful as it is it's driven by spirit. You know, Sylvia is a woman who's not just intellectually inclined because of her law degree, but she's spiritually based. So here's a woman who's procreator, and then, you know, because people have been talking about this, and like Myron says, banging our heads against the wall. We knew something had to happen, but we didn't know how to go about it. We felt hopeless. We didn't know what to get behind. Who's leading something? Is anyone leading anything? Is anyone saying anything? It was just like, it was depressing. And then all of a sudden, you know, the spirit moves through Sylvia, and she starts talking about it, and energy just took off, and I believe that it's the spirit that's what I got behind. When I went to my very first meeting, I said, you know, I am affected by the spirit that's moving this, and I'm here to serve that, specifically that spirit. It was prophesied years ago, over 100 years ago, by Big Bear. So this is a prophecy that's happening, and it's about waking the spirit up, and we're all serving that one thing, and we need all of our brothers and sisters, not acknowledging borders or divisions or any exclusion.
I think it's really interesting to hear you say that because, you know, this whole 2012 and people talking about the Mayan prophecies, not to belittle any of that. I can't say I really understand that well, but it's just interesting that people were looking south, but something new came from the north. It's just kind of an interesting thing.
Well, it's a collaboration of everyone. I mean, Indigenous peoples are all rooted in the same belief system. I believe that anyways. So, you know, it's a universal thought process that's happening, and it's an awakening of the globe because it's necessary, you know. And it was a prophecy that was spoken of years ago. So, you know, this is going to happen, and as long as we continue to keep the focus, it's going to, I think, we'll overcome in this situation. We have to.
All right. Well, I really want to thank you, Georgia Lightning, calling from Edmonton. Or we called you, but talking from Edmonton. And I'm speaking also with Myron Lehman from the Beaver Lake Cree from Alberta.
Yep.
And what's the nearest city to there?
It would be Edmonton.
Edmonton, yeah. And we're winding down here. We got a couple minutes left. Anything, any last thoughts, Myron?
Really, you know, if you're in a public place, you know, and you happen to see a bunch of Indians just kind of hanging around wondering, hey, what's going on? You know, stick around. You might see something really good. You might, you know, and just, you know, have an open mind, open heart and, you know, and just listen and, yeah, just keep your eyes out because they're hanging out. They got their drums there. They're ready to go.
Yeah. I mean, it's just been amazing how many of these, round dance flash mob has been going on all over the country. There's been dozens and dozens. There's one in D.C. on New Year's Eve. There's Denver at the Canadian consulate. Seems like people are all starting to, you know, also focus on the Canadian consulates and embassies around the country too. Kathleen, do we have a little bit of that Cree round dance CD that's queued up there to go out with? All right, so you've been listening to Political Perspectives. My name is Paul Rowland. I've had Myron Lehman and Georgina Lightning and earlier Sylvia McAdam, one of the four women who kind of got the ball rolling by doing some teach-ins in November that under the I Don't Know More hashtag. Thanks a lot for listening. This is your listener-sponsored community radio station, KBOO Portland 90.7.
This is KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Flashpoints, followed by The Bike Show at 11 a.m.
Today on Flashpoints, we have a New Year's special focusing on the 209th anniversary of the independence of the nation of Haiti. Stay tuned, we'll be right back. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Welcome back. And today is the 209th anniversary of the independence of the nation of Haiti. So I'm going to devote the entire hour today to Haiti and all things Haitian, something that I happen to know a little bit about, having lived there for seven years, from 1999 to 2006, during a very difficult period of that country's history. To begin today, though, I'd like to introduce and bring in a dear friend of mine and a good friend of the show. He's been on often, and that's Ira Kurzban. Ira Kurzban served as the legal counsel for the government of Haiti for over a decade, spanning two administrations, the administration of Jean-Bertrand Aristide and René Garcia Préval. In addition to that, he is also one of the foremost immigration law experts in the country. He's written a book that is widely used by judges and lawyers throughout the United States. So before we get to Haiti, first of all, let me welcome you on to Flashpoints. Welcome to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, Ira Kurzban.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and a Happy New Year to you and your listeners.
Happy New Year to you, too. And thank you so much for joining us today. I did this at short notice, so I'm really, really happy that you could join us. Listen, I know that we're going to talk a little bit about Haiti in a bit, but I wanted to start, since you are one of the foremost experts on immigration law in the United States, I want to sort of to get an accounting of you of where immigration reform stands today. It not only affects, of course, Haitians, many Haitians who've been tied up in the legal system for years, many of them who don't know their status, many of them who can't get out of